Here we are again. It's fun to be back. We took a little hiatus, but now we're here again. So, we're right in the middle. We're at the beginning of chapter 14 of Swamiji's book, which is right in the middle of chapter 3 of the Gita. And the 10 pages that we're working with tonight don't have a single Gita verse in them, so I can't read anything to you. This is a kind of transition where Swamiji is having to set the stage for these verses which come later, which require a certain amount of background, is sort of the best way I can think about it. We have to appreciate when we're reading this book from America that even though this book is written in English, Swamiji was writing this very strongly for an Indian audience as well as an American audience. So for Americans, he's introducing us in a sense. I mean, not this crowd, he's not introducing to the Gita, but he wrote this book to introduce the West to the Gita in Master's way. But in the East, what he's writing to do is to correct a certain amount of non-understanding of what the Gita is, or to take on very long-standing levels of misunderstanding or lack of appreciation of the deeper truths. And so in this particular 10-page transition right in the middle of chapter 3 of the Gita, Swamiji is really having to talk to a reality that is not necessarily part of Western reality, but is very deeply a part of Indian reality. But it's important for us to understand, it's just not burning questions that's been in our mind. Because the next sections of the Gita are all about Krishna talking about yajnas and rituals and propitiating devas and getting angels on your side and the various rituals that you have to do. And those are not things that we are doing on a daily basis, but in the context of Indian culture for hundreds and hundreds of years, for thousands of years, all of these issues of what is the efficacy of ritual, what role do the priests play? How much karma can you work out just by asking people to do rituals for you? I mean, even just now, friends of ours, one of my Ananda friends was in a difficult astrological period, and so one of our Indian friends hired a priest to say 100,000 Gayatri mantras on his behalf. And on the day that the 100,000 Gayatri mantras were completed, then the priest came over and we did a whole puja in their house, and we sort of finished the last of the mantras and we finished them all together, and all of this was supposed to help him overcome the karmic difficulties that astrological period represented. I mean, and our friends who did this are perfectly westernized, highly educated Indians. It's not like something that people who are not educated only do. It's just sort of the understood thing that the priests know these rituals, and these rituals have power, and we can, well, in fact, one of the difficulties with Hinduism, as one of my Indian friends told me, he said it is one of the only religions where you can't practice it yourself. You have to pay someone to practice it for you, because the rituals have become so complicated that only the hereditary, you have to be raised up from childhood in a family of what they call pujaris, which is hereditary priests, to even know how to do it. And then it's a profession. You become a pujari. And in situations like this, where someone needs a ritual done, then you get paid and you come in and you do it. And some priests are divinely inspired and many are not. You know, it's a job. It's their hereditary position. My friend, this is a different friend, the system for buying property in India has been the kind of system where it's not designed to spread the ownership of property out. This was the situation in Europe too. These are all new to us. I was saying in Sunday service, there's so many things about America that are so perfect for self-realization because they encourage an egalitarian attitude toward life that we don't even think about them. We just take them for granted, such as the fact that anybody can buy property because the bank will give you the money. I mean, somebody was really smart and figured out that you can pay for it over 30 years and I can make a lot of interest and I have the money, I'll give you the money and you can have the property. But what that means is that people can pull themselves up by their bootstraps And anybody, with whether they have any breeding or family or anything behind them, can rise to the level of being an influential person just by hard work. Well, there are many societies that have no wish to have that happen. I mean, not only do we allow that to happen, but we have the mindset where that's desirable. But many cultures where you have an invested power group with wealth and money and land, the last thing they want is for everybody to have access to land. So they make it so that you have to pay for it all before you can have it. In his situation, I'm not quite sure how it worked, but he paid it off over 3 years, but he couldn't take possession of his condominium, or 5 years. He couldn't take possession until it was all paid for. So it was finished and empty, but it had to sit there until he had finished paying it off. And then, this is the whole point I was going to say, he couldn't move in for 5 more months because the priest said it was inauspicious. And before he could possibly move in, the proper Vedic ceremonies had to be done in the house, and they couldn't be done for 5 months. So after all that time, he had to wait 5 more months. And then they built a fire, you know, a sacred fire in the middle of the living room, and broke coconuts against the wall. So after that was all done, he had to have the whole place repaired and restored back to new, and then he could finally move in. Okay, now this was like yesterday. This was not like, and this is one of, these are my most Western friends in India, but it was just unthinkable that he would have moved in. If he might have been able to consider it, his family would never have allowed it. Now, what Swami's writing about in this little transition section of chapter 3 of the Gita is trying to explain sort of where all of this fits in. Because the next verses of the Gita, Krishna is going to be telling us how to propitiate the devas and the angels and which yagyas to do and how they're beneficial and how we should carry them out. And we have to get our minds around this in the right way. So Swamiji just starts from the beginning trying to explain it to us like this. You know, the name of the section is, the chapter is directional development. Now, directional is a concept that has always been fundamental to the success of Ananda. If you haven't put your mind to it in this way, let me talk about it a little bit. One of the reasons, one of the characteristics of Swami Kriyananda's genius as a leader is his understanding that development is directional. And the way that manifests on the simple practical plane is that whenever anyone over all these 40 years has gone to him with some difficulty, whatever the difficulty is, no matter how massive it may seem, he can always find a way to give you a suggestion that allows you to make a step you can actually make in the right direction. It's never a question of, oh, you failed, oh, you have to do this or else you'll go to hell. You know, this is the only alternative. It's that it's all directional. So all we ever have to be doing is we just have to be moving. We have to be, I say it like this, we don't even actually have to be moving. We just at least have to be facing the right direction, preferably moving, preferably standing up. But even just facing the right direction is enough. Because then when we actually do get in motion, we'll go in the right direction. And so many religious works absolutely crash and burn on the rocks of the belief that it's either yes or no, without realizing that as long as you're trying to do the right thing and moving in the right direction, then eventually it's all going to work out. In fact, I recall very vividly many of you went through the Bertolucci lawsuit, and for those of you know were here when we went through it, for those of you who weren't, I'm going to give you this much of a summary. A man at Ananda Village who was married had an affair with an unmarried woman. The unmarried woman, he made the decision to go back with his wife. When he made that decision, of course Swami supported him in that decision. That was the decision he was hoping he would make. The woman scorned, became enraged. She became enraged not only at the man, but at Swami, because she felt that Swami hadn't supported him, she would have won him from his wife. That's the bare bones of it. By the time the whole thing was finished, we're being raked through the coals in the papers because for the oddest things. You know, the media being what they are, they just randomly choose things. But one thing they chose was the fact that once the man made the decision to stay with his wife, we all stuck with him and tried to help him make that decision. Whereas we should have had a code of conduct that says this is what's acceptable and this is what's not acceptable, and once a person crossed that line, then they should be expelled, because this man had the status of being a minister. Okay, and instead of just sort of knocking, you know, he was already down and out, instead of kicking him and stomping him and throwing him out on the sidewalk, we stood by him. And in the twisted logic of the way the world is, that was considered to be a bad thing, because don't you have any standards? Yes, we do have standards. And those standards are that development is directional. And if a person falls and then gets up and starts walking again in the right direction, for heaven's sakes, we're going to help them. Why would we not have helped them? We were helping her, too. But she just chose to walk away from it. But isn't that strange? It took me a long time to realize what people were so mad at us about. I couldn't figure it out for a long time. What they're really mad at us about was for being kind. And we all just made a very strong decision that we'd rather go down in flames being kind than become like religion always is. So this whole concept of directional development is really fundamental to self-realization. If you add in, think how many incarnations we've had, think how many times karma just explodes and we don't know what to do with ourselves, the understanding continuously that it's directional and you just keep moving, there's no absolute. You don't ever, until you or God realize, but then these are not your problems anymore. But between now and that phase, just keep going. That's all that matters. Success is not measured, even by whether you succeed or fail, just that you just keep going and just don't quit. Swamiji was talking about different incarnations of his I think it was somewhere over the last month. My whole sense of time and space is, like many of yours, is just completely fragmented at this point. But I think he was talking about it recently, about some of his difficulties with SRF being because of past life experiences in which he genuinely was misguided and was not supportive of his guru, and then those disciples were very upset with him, and so they hold him in the light of a person who's not loyal to his guru, even though he's long since overcome that. But listen to what he's saying. You know, within reasonable memory of this cycle of time, Swamiji can talk about not being loyal to his guru. And then yet, you look at the life that he's lived now. I think in that same context, Swamiji was talking about Judas 2,000 years ago, a little over that. Judas got so confused that he stood up and tried to, make Jesus behave in the way that he wanted him to behave. I mean, it's called a betrayal, and rightly so. They would have found some other way of crucifying him anyway. But Judas was the very unfortunate instrument that got so mixed up that he sided against his own guru and then hung himself afterwards. I mean, it was a pretty grisly incarnation when you sort of add it all up. He gets to be one of the 12 apostles, and then at the end, his name is literally synonymous with everything that's black. You know, if you really want to insult someone, you call them a Judas. It's become its own word. And yet, Master declared that Judas was liberated in the last century as the disciple of Sri Ramakrishna, that Jesus sent him to Ramakrishna, and Ramakrishna acted the part of his guru and on behalf of Jesus, liberated him. Everything is over. And so it's really important to understand that this process happens in a gradual way, and wherever you're standing just makes no difference at all. We can't help where we are now, in the sense that unconsciously we just did lots of really bad things. You know, you're just not on the spiritual path, and then you are on the spiritual path. And even once you're on the spiritual path, them little vrittis, they just sneak right out there and grab your consciousness and make you do the damnedest things. And then afterwards you think, what was wrong with me? What could I have been thinking? I can't tell you, I'm sure you're the same. How many times in your life you look back and you think, what could I have been thinking? And yet at the time it seemed like such a good idea. Or at least it seemed like a reasonable idea or an irresistible idea or something. But you think, what could I have been thinking? And you know, you can just keep taking that on and on. I'm sure Judas looked back at his life with Jesus and thought, what could I have been thinking? It seemed like a good idea at the time, but it just goes on and on like that. Now, the other aspect of that, which leads us, you know, back into where we are with the Gita here, is this fact that therefore, at any point, there's always going to be a continuum of realization in the beings all around you. It's not like everybody is ignorant and then they're saved. See, there's so many mistakes in Christianity as it's presently presented now that is not at all the way Jesus had it. We're all sinners, then we accept Jesus, then we all become saved. And there's no intervening section in that. I remember I saw this woman, she had tattooed across her back. I couldn't quite read it because the letters were kind of fancy. She had this tattoo that went shoulder to shoulder across her back. We were somewhere and it was summer and she was wearing some tiny little top that revealed the whole thing. And she was working in this place where we were going for coffee often. We were on a holiday somewhere. And every day we all sort of look at her and we try to guess what she said on her back. You didn't want to be too odd about it. But she had letters like this. And then I saw her reading the Bible and that I realized it said redeemed. She had tattooed across her back, redeemed, and there she was reading the Bible. And for God's sake, I prayed that she was, because it'd be an awful tattoo to have if you fell away, you know? But I thought, well, I mean, that's, and more power to her. I mean, you could tell from looking at her that a lot of things had happened to her before she was redeemed. And so you could see why she tattooed it on her back. It must have been a great moment when she realized she wasn't lost forever. But still, it's like, there you are, you're nothing, and then all of a sudden you're this. And there's sort of like there's nothing much for you to do in the middle. The problem is, I've often said, for the Jews is even worse, because at least the Jews just have nothing to do, because there's no masters, there's no saints, there's no example of somebody like doing the whole thing and showing you. Christians did the same thing by taking Jesus out of the human equation entirely. So he's completely out of the human equation. He's the only begotten Son of God, that virgin birth, immaculate conception of Mary, you know, just like, whoa, nobody's going to duplicate those conditions ever again. There he is, he's it. And then there's everybody else who are sinners, actually, condemned by poor Adam and Eve. I mean, the whole thing really breaks down if you try hard. But the result is, you can't really do it yourself. You don't have anything. You get up in the morning. I mean, you can try to emulate Christ, but it's a very difficult system. The Jews, because there's nobody, it's blasphemy even, although in fact, you know, they become dedicated to their rabbis and you develop what are really guru-disciple relationships with your teachers, but you can't call it that. But you have, again, you have no example of the human consciousness evolving individually, of there being a gradual expansion of consciousness that I can participate in, not only by the grace of God, but also by my specific efforts. Now, that's why we're not Hindus or Catholics or Jews or anything like that. We're all yogis. And yoga, which is the scientific practice of consciousness expanding exercises, that's the unifying factor, because all the religions in one form or another are trying to teach you yoga. Whether it's by pure bhakti to Jesus and absolute, you know, guru devotion, guru bhakti to Jesus, or by the Jews, by right action, by honorable living, by a generous and noble spirit. Nonetheless, it's all one form or another of yoga, which is we're expanding. Remember we said earlier, we're expanding our joy, we're expanding our awareness, we're expanding our compassionate heart. And merely to hope for that and try, it works better if you have techniques for dealing with all those little vrittis that just keep capturing our good intentions and eating us alive. And that's where Kriya and practices like it just sort of accelerate the whole thing. But at any point in reality, we're dealing with this spectrum of consciousness from the most unenlightened to the most enlightened. And the project of, the project of our expansion of consciousness isn't just a matter of us working all by ourselves on this level. That there's many levels of reality happening all at the same time. And Swamiji goes through this sort of long discussion about how whatever level of consciousness we're on, we need to be aware of two realities. One, that there are conscious beings on a higher level than we are, and there are conscious beings on a lower level than we are. And that our appropriate relationship to both those realities is fundamental to expanding from the point that we are right now. And he goes through this wonderful sort of description about how everything is evolving. I know Swami made a very charming statement once. He became interested for a period of time. Let's see, what was it? There was a period of time when he started tuning into to dogs for some reason. I can't remember what exactly prompted it. I can remember he actually gave a satsang here, and he imitated dog consciousness so perfectly. Do you remember that his face just became non-human suddenly? He just suddenly had the face of a happy little puppy. And then it was just a second. I think somebody caught it on camera. Just a second, and then it went back to being his own face. But it was because everything is just a state of consciousness. Whatever you're looking at a state of consciousness. And he was saying about, he's always had this very interesting relationship to animals, because Swamiji is not at all sentimental like some people are. Remember how that master talked about somebody handed a little baby to him, and he looked at the baby, and he almost dropped it, because when he looked into the face of the baby, he saw the carried over consciousness of a murderer. So everybody thinks it's this innocent little baby, but it wasn't innocent in the past. Obviously, this baby had good karma because somebody handed him to master. So whatever he had done, he must have repented. But this was no innocent baby, you know, goo goo, goo goo, little cutie pie. This was a murderer. He just looked in his eyes, and there he was. I know. We went with Swamiji to see a documentary film about Mother Teresa many years ago. It was here in Palo Alto. And it was a very, you know, she was a magnificent soul, and what she did was, from the average person's point of view, just seemed superhuman. And they showed lots of pictures of her going out on the street and picking up these maggot-infested, dying people and, you know, just embracing them. So there were lots of pictures of her face really close to sick and dying and poor, very, very down and out souls. So you could see them as much as you could see her. And we walked out of the movie, and Swamiji, who was always very impersonal, he said, I know this wouldn't be popular, and here I'm going to say it on this. He said, it's not something we should say often, he said, but when you see those poor down and out people and you look into your eyes, you can see how they ended up there. You know, you can see in their eyes the consciousness that brought them to that state. Of course, because why else would they be there? Of course, they also had the good karma to have her come into their lives. And not everyone who's down and out has that look in their eye. We used to see, he must have passed away now, when we first started going to Varanasi in India. And on our first trips to India, you see lots of beggars. And mostly, at least I don't feel inclined to give them money, even though they're pathetic in various ways. There's just something in it. It doesn't inspire. Then we went to the bazaar in Benares, and the bazaar is the really old part of town where the streets are really narrow and the taxis drop you on the outside, and then you walk into what is really a maze of very small streets. And there's cows and scooters and people, but there's no automobiles. It's way too little, and you just kind of wander through this maze, and then eventually you'll come out. And at one of the entrances to that bazaar, there was a beggar who he might have just had a torso. Maybe he had hands, but he had no legs. At least his legs were cut off right to his hips. He didn't have any legs at all. And he was on this little platform with wheels. No, he had hands because he pushed himself with his hands. So he was at ground level. He was about 6 inches off the ground. He had this, and he looked up, and he had the most beatific smile and just completely angelic nature. And this was one of our very early trips to India, and it was just like so striking. It was odd because it didn't even occur to you to give him money, because it was sort of like, what did he need from us? But he was just there begging because he was completely helpless, and he was just in the most terrible circumstance, but he'd completely transcended it. He was just completely something else. And we saw him for a few years, and then he ceased to be there. Probably his life ended. It couldn't have been. Must have been a very difficult life for him. But still, it was completely something else. The consciousness in his eyes was entirely different than so many other people in those circumstances. It's you have to be very impersonal about these things. You can't let sentiment rule you. And so I was starting to say this about Swamiji. He's never sentimental about animals or children, really. He just looks at children, and they're just children, and he just relates to them according to their consciousness, which includes the fact that they're children, but just according to their consciousness. And he relates to animals sort of in the same impersonal way, according to their consciousness. His word for most dogs has always been, "Hello, beast," is what he would say, in a very sort of amusing way. But something must have happened, because for a while he started talking about the fact that he sort of saw all creatures, you know, whether animal or human, as just a continuum of consciousness somewhere, you know, between ego identity and liberation from the ego. And there was just, it was just a smooth continuum. And you shifted body to body out of animal into human, and then out of human into angelic, if that's going to be the karma that you're going to work out, and then transcending that also and going into the causal and the liberated worlds completely. But all of it is, it's just a spectrum. More recently he's been saying, we're just bundles of self-definitions, and everyone is just a bundle of self-definitions. But that would be true for a dog. He's just the infinite spirit who's defined as a dog at that point, because a dog body is the limit of his awareness at that point. You know, dogs have a certain awareness, but only so much, and that's all they have. And people, the human body can have more awareness, and then once we're at the human level, there's a vast spectrum of awareness that's possible once we have a human body. The human body has, as Master put it, a nervous system sophisticated enough to be aware of infinity. A dog's body, the nervous system is not sophisticated enough. That's why the dogs have tails, because the consciousness is so much at the end, and they express all their energy from the bottom of their spine. You know, that's how animals express themselves, from the bottom of the spine, whereas we try to express from the top of the spine. Although it's very, you know, popular these days, when people get excited, they wiggle their hips like that. It's not a very good practice for a yogi. Because you really don't want to be enjoying things from the bottom of your spine. You really want to be enjoying it from the top. I mean, that's why all that kind of dancing is not really good for yogis, because that's really what you're doing, is you're emphasizing the energy at the bottom of the spine. That's not where you want to be living. So anyway, Swamiji talks in this chapter in such an interesting way about how it's good for pets to be with humans, because it raises their consciousness. And it's good for people of lower consciousness to be with people of higher consciousness. This is the divine reality behind servants. Somebody who might have a very limited life, if they get taken up by a more sophisticated, more educated, more well-to-do family, such a person may suddenly find themselves in circumstances that they would never have encountered before, and it can greatly accelerate their evolution. And so Swamiji is talking about, for each of us as individuals, it helps us to help those who understand less than we do, whatever realm that might be, not with pride or arrogance, but just out of for a number of reasons. One, because it expands the sympathy of our heart. Also, because it reinforces what we know. That's the real reason why so many religions emphasize proselytizing. You know, it, again, like everything else, it's become terribly confused. It's like you have to save their souls from purgatory or something like that. That's not why. It's because whatever stage of evolution you're on, you need to strengthen your understanding of that by constantly re-explaining it to others and developing the patience and the understanding, the expansion of sympathies, the realization of your own capacity to be a channel for the infinite, the appreciation for what it is that you know by sharing it with others. If you just take it into yourself and never repeat it, among other things, it may go vague in your mind. And it also keeps your energy fresh. I've thanked God every day that from the very beginning of my time at Ananda, virtually, Swamiji has always had me explaining it to others. And among the many, 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 many joyful benefits of that, not the least of which is it's brought me in contact with so many wonderful people, is that I get to see in the eyes of other people reflected back to me that sense of, my God, isn't this wonderful? You know, especially people who you're telling them for the first time they meditate, the first time they cognize a concept, and you see this dawning look in their eyes and the extraordinary realization of, what this is going to mean. And it saves a person such as myself, who's been doing this for a long time, from becoming even slightly jaded about it. You just constantly know, this is wonderful. And this is what Swami's talking about, this directional development. The fact of it being directional development means that there are people you can always help. Master's original lessons, which are he wrote quickly when he first came to America, they were gradually refined. What SRF publishes now is not written by Master's hand. It's a compilation of transcripts of talks and excerpts from various things. So it's not his hand. It doesn't have his vital spirit at all. But original versions of the lessons, which float around on the internet now in all sorts of places, some of the versions are really startling. I mean, one of them, very, very strongly, now that you have discovered this liberating teaching of self-realization, you have a divine obligation to share it. You should give away, I think he says, 10 copies of autobiography, you know, every month, or at least one copy of autobiography every week. You should talk to someone every day about these teachings. You should never let a day pass in which you don't tell someone about these teachings. It's, you know, it's not at all the, oh, just go quietly into my room and meditate. I don't want to be dogmatic. I don't want to be pushing this on other people. Nothing at all like that. He wants you standing on the street corners and telling the world about it. I remember in the early, this was one of those really memorable early Ananda stories. It couldn't have been much past 1972. It was just right there at the very beginning. 72, right around in there. Swamiji, he might have taken the play, it might have been the play, The Jewel and the Lotus. He might have taken that play, and he was speaking in Reno, Nevada, which was just over the hill from Ananda Village. And he was doing this program in Reno. It might have been sponsored by the Science of Religion Church. Maybe Swami just set up an outreach program in Reno, Nevada. Maybe it was, I think it was just set up because we were staying with Satya's son, who was the lion tamer. And there were 25 of us in this house with one bathroom. That's a story that was often told. And the family afterwards was just amazed by how harmoniously we lived there. Well, this was just, we were all just in the very beginning of things. And Swamiji, we were trying to promote this. Swamiji, first of all, we wore Indian clothes the whole time we were in Reno, which in itself was like, you know, not like common. And then Swamiji wanted us to promote what we were doing, and I think it was his idea. We went down and we sat on the sidewalk in front of the Kmart, and we did kirtan in Indian clothes in Reno, Nevada. You know, at the time, I was so new, it just seemed like, sure, you know. Haridas and I have talked about this, because I just thought the whole thing was such a lark. I didn't care. It just didn't, nothing mattered to me in those days. I was very seldom embarrassed by anything. For Haridas, who was much shyer by nature, it was just, he remembers it as just the height of mortification. I just remember it as just a jolly, happy time. You know, we compared notes on this recently. He talked about just, you know, having to go really deep into his spine. But at the time, I thought we were really just trying to promote Swami's classes, which we were. But it was not really like the most effective kind of promotion you can imagine. I think he was also just trying to get us to just even begin to think about the fact this is not something we're going to keep. We're going to just put this out. We're going to put it out anyway at all. And don't be embarrassed. You know, just this is what you have and this is who you're going to be. And just literally stand on the sidewalk and tell people about it in Reno. You know, I don't think one person came from seeing us sitting there. Who knows? None of those details are clear in my mind. But when I read here about it, and when I read later about Master's energy, that's one side of it, which is we've always got to be expanding our own awareness by helping for our own sakes. You know, how much can you actually help the world if it's somebody's karma to find out about God, then they will find out about God. And if you don't help them, somebody else will help them. But it's we who will miss by not stepping into that reality. But then, of course, the other side of it is the receptivity necessary to understand that we are not the top of the pyramid. Merely because we can reach backward and help this person means that we also have to reach upward and have somebody else take our hand. And it's just a movement that never stops. Master himself used to give all the credit to Babaji and Sri Yukteswar. That's not printed as much in some of the literature as it should be. But Swamiji even told a very peculiar story about, I can't remember the details of it, but it was Master himself being unable to take an action to save himself from some situation until he called on Sri Yukteswar. Coming at Master. Yeah, and Swami tells the same story of being rescued from a dark entity by calling on Yogananda, and then Yogananda tells about being rescued from a dark entity by calling on Sri Yukteswar. I mean, how's that for an example? Because there isn't a point at which it stops. And Jesus on the cross, in the last moment, what does he cry out for? He calls out, this man is calling for Elias, they said. And that was his guru, for Elijah. He was calling for Elijah. And that was his master in the previous incarnation. At the moment of him departing from his body, isn't this an important lesson for us? And now, it's not just a question of, oh, I will listen to Yogananda. We used to have this extraordinary energy at Ananda Village in the early years when Swamiji was playing his leadership so low-key that there were many people there who didn't know he was the leader. And there was always this thought, well, Swami says he's not a fully self-realized master, therefore, how do we know what he says is true? You know, I'll take instruction from Master, which I just make up because I can just get it inside, but I'm not sure, you know, I just don't know whether I should listen to Swami. But such people never really advanced at all. And I used to say, because I'm a Cancer and I tend to see things a little personally, it was necessary to tune into Swami per se, or else they would not. The way I put it was different than that. I said people who tune into Swami advance, succeed, flower. People who don't. That's just the way I watched it. But I realized it was much more, even more impersonal than that. It was just the simple thought. Either one recognizes, I need all the help I can get, or one just simply holds on to the ego and thinks, you know, I'll take in certain influences, but I'm going to really do this myself, and who can really teach me? Whereas, in fact, this is a vibratory universe, and there's many, many, many subtle levels of vibration. Of course, a great disciple of a great master is a good one. My answer to that was always, well, the difference between Swami and Master is not perceivable by me. But the difference between me and Swami is a really clear gap. So I'm just going to work with him until I'm to the point where I think it makes any difference. Of course, it never made any difference. But it was just obvious. Of course he could teach me. I mean, what a thought that I am so close to perfection that only someone with no, absolutely nothing to learn themselves could ever teach me anything. Doesn't that sound just a teeny weeny bit arrogant? But we sort of get ourselves into that thought form because we're not understanding the simple concept that it's all directional. And then Swamiji, in this section of the book, takes it in a whole other direction and just talks about the fact that there's, in addition to souls, jivas, which are in physical bodies, you have many other dimensions of reality happening at all times. And some of them are angels and devas or demons, but you have astral beings who are not in physical bodies, but are yet individual souls, many of whom are very advanced, and many of these angels work with this planet all the time. And so it isn't just souls that we can see, but I'm not talking about disincarnate dead spirits either. Now, Andrew and I were talking this afternoon about, she remembered, she was quoting back to me from years and years ago about when I was responding to somebody who channeled some entity, and I said in my common sense way, just because a person is dead doesn't mean that they're wise, you know? Just because somebody's on the other side talking through somebody on this side doesn't mean they have anything to say that you really can learn from. In fact, most of the time, channeled entities are not high entities because it's not in the natural order for more than one consciousness to use one brain. And it's not good for the brain being used to have the overlay of another person's consciousness on top of your own. Just think about how complex that'll be. You know, all those impressions, all those thoughts and energies, even this, I don't even know if she's still there, Jay-Z Knight, who was so popular so many years ago. I read the most pathetic article about her because I think she's genuinely I don't know anything about her, and I don't even really want to know, but the impression I had was that she was genuinely possessed by some other entity. By the way she described it, she was very, very popular at one point. And she would actually blank out, and whoever it was would take over and use her body. And after doing this for years and years, she said, she remarked, and this is what I read in this little article, in what struck me as just a heartrending manner, that she was absent for a great deal of her life. Because this entity would come over and just suppress her personality, and she would essentially go unconscious. It would do things. She wouldn't have any idea what had been done, and then she'd come back. It's horrible. Plus the incredible chaos that results from someone else literally using your body that way. So we're not talking about that. But we're talking about refined and elevated beings who from the astral world help this world or other worlds. But just like we don't stop working. If we think of directional development, I know when Paula died, she sort of was talking to Swami just before she died and said something like, "I hope Master has a job for me. You know, I don't like to be idle." And Master said, Swami said, I'm sure he'll keep you very busy, Paula. Because it was just, that's true. If she has this desire to help, why would it change in the astral world? I asked Swamiji a question once somebody asked him about people having dreams of him that were true dreams, that felt true to them. And as Swamiji himself said, he would give them the same advice he would have given them if he'd had the chance to give it to them. And even others of us, you know, from time to time we'll dream about one another. And there'll be a very real feeling about it. And sometimes very positive and helpful exchanges happen in our sleep. And I asked Swamiji about that. What is that really? He thought for a moment. First he said, "I don't know," was his first answer. Then his second answer was, "The super consciousness never sleeps." Think about that. It's only the physical body and the mind that go to sleep. The super consciousness is beyond the physical and it never sleeps. He said, "Why, when your body goes to sleep, would your heart's desire to help people go to sleep? You're still yourself when you sleep." And so if in the sleep state, you know, other people are more receptive or you're more receptive, why would it not happen? Because it's only your body that's asleep, right? Everything else is still going. And Swami was remarking that death is just the same. That's the emphasis. When you go to sleep, you lose consciousness, but when you wake up, you're still there, and you even remember what happened. You know that something happened. How did you sleep? You know how you slept, which is to say that some part of you retained consciousness, and you're just the same, only you've had a night's sleep. Swami was going on with the analogy that when you die, the body goes to sleep, but it doesn't wake up. But who you are just continues, and all of that desire to be serviceful to God and Guru, to help others, to participate in this beautiful existence of mutual service would just continue. And so you just go into the astral world and you just keep it up. And if you have the karma to be in the astral world for a while, it wouldn't be any fun for people like us just to sit there. Swamiji refers to people who go into sort of heavenly realms with a passive attitude of, "Now I'm reaping my just reward." He said, but they don't really gain very much spiritually. They just sit back and take. And you don't really grow very much when you do. But people like us, we'd get bored very, very quickly. You know, we just, "Can't I help someone?" You know, it's just like this sort of charge builds up. "Can't I help someone?" So we would. And we would either be serviceful in the astral world or, more likely, we'd help Master's mission in any way we could. We'd be the angelic beings who are, you know, helping. Angelic compared to some, maybe angelic compared to many. And they're all there all the time. The rishis see them all the time. People who have expanded sight can see these angelic beings. Remember our singers, our little group of singers, when they were first learning Chant of the Angels, which we now call Life Mantra, that beautiful long choral piece, which Swamiji said he heard it. He heard it being sung, and then he wrote it down. He didn't even know what the chords were. He had to just sort of write down what he heard and then figure it out later. But when our little group was singing it, which actually turned out to be the first time that it was sung for Swami, was with our group of singers, when they were rehearsing, they paused for a moment and three of the five heard voices continue. Just the phrase went on. because the angels were there just in the chorus singing it with them. How else to explain sometimes some of the musical performances that we've had here? When there's no possible explanation for how well we sing and how full the room feels, even when there's only a few people in it. But I'm certain that the angels gather, say, hey, they're having a concert down at Ananda. You know, and they just come, they just sing along from the back. And even if their voices are not audible, they're audible to the heart, and then the heart interprets what it hears on a much more elevated level. Well, see, isn't it much more beneficial to cooperate with these realities? And one of the things that's just absolutely destroying us now, I mean, yes, it can be quantified in terms of, you know, tearing up the rainforest and flying all over the world in these gas-guzzling whatevers they are, and, you know, all those things. And then you can measure this and this and this and this. But those are all actual, the final symptoms of what is really a matter of consciousness, which is that the human ego, collectively, in this particular time and place, is completely forgotten that we exist in this spectrum of consciousness. We don't understand our responsibility for the less evolved, and we don't understand the necessity to be respectful and receptive to the more evolved, even on the level of just nature spirits and woodland devas and all those elements which are not necessarily particularly highly evolved. Swamiji tells the most interesting story about being at Findhorn back in the years when Findhorn was really flourishing and doing all these very remarkable things in cooperation with the nature spirits and doing, you know, logic-defying feats of gardening, growing plants in the cold and growing plants that couldn't be grown in sizes and shapes, because they had developed this very strong relationship with the nature spirits there and individuals who were in charge. And it was something really unusual happening. Well, Swamiji was invited to speak there, and a group went. Swamiji said he found it extremely difficult to say anything. It was just like there was this force that was trying to keep him from speaking, and this sort of unwelcome force. And it wasn't coming from the people there, although the people manifested it to a certain extent. He said the only time he ever felt at all free was when he sang. But every time he tried to teach anything, there was just this really strong force. And he said, and it stayed with him until he was completely off the property. And then when he was about 10 miles down the road, he felt it lift. His explanation for it, he really sincerely felt, was that the nature devas were really threatened by him. Because they'd gotten a little puffed up with themselves, is how he put it. Because they'd gotten so much attention from these people, and they were really very important. And Swamiji's teaching was higher than that. Because it wasn't about the nature devas, it was about the divine and God's presence everywhere. This is something also that a few years ago, that movie Brother, Son, Sister Moon came out a few years, is like 20 or 25, whatever it was. And there's something that almost everyone goes through sooner or later, which is you actually recommend a movie to Swami. And then if you're unfortunate enough to actually go with him to sit through it, you see him fold his arms and you hear him go like that. And you realize that you're really in for it. Because basically the way I put it to him is, I said, we're just so inured to the grossness of modern cinema that we don't even see until we're sitting next to you how really god-awful a great deal of the stuff is. But when you're sitting next to him, you suddenly realize all the incredibly immoral, crude, horrible things about the films come out to you. Or in this particular case, that movie wasn't immoral and crude, but it was spiritually extremely naive. But everybody told Swami it was such a wonderful movie, and so a whole crowd of us were all so excited. We went to see Brother, Son, Sister Moon with Swamiji, and it was a very short time. He's going, you know, and the whole row is just like, you know, and it's very hard from that point on to enjoy it. It's very hard to hold your center and say, I liked it. I did like it. It becomes a spiritual exercise. I understand all of that, sir, but I still liked it. But what he couldn't bear about that movie, first of all, is it made Francis, this is a long time ago, but it made St. Francis seem like a nincompoop, just sort of wandering around like he was a little stoned all the time, and then things would happen. You know, and he would look really kind of confused, and then he would go forward again. I mean, there was nothing of the really powerful, focused, dynamic courage of a true saint. And more than that, they made it seem as if St. Francis both drew his inspiration and worshipped the flowers, the birds, the little animals. That wasn't true at all. Francis was in direct communion with Christ and God. This is way bigger than the fairies, you know? And from that state of consciousness, what Francis's revolution, spiritual revolution, was that he proclaimed the presence of God throughout creation, which was a new idea, because it was the beginning of, you know, the Kali Yuga's winding down a bit, we're getting to go into Dwapar, and we're able to think in more expansive ways. And his poem in praise of Brother Sun, Sister Moon was to point out that God resides in these things and that we can experience the presence of God through the created universe. We don't just have to be renunciates in a cave who turn our back on everything. But you see, this is very, very different than worshiping them as entities in themselves. That's why Swamiji's response to the necessity to relate to the natural world is the song channels. The channels, the nature channel song. Birds sing of freedom as they soar lightly on the air. So may our hearts soar above all curbs and cares. Trees standing firm show the secret of inner power. Is that right? Yes. Give us, when tested, strength to endure. You see, they all become symbols. You don't in any part of that say, you don't personify the tree as actually having a conscious wisdom in itself to give you. And yet, because of our humble receptivity, we recognize that everything can teach us and that they're all expressions of the divine. You see the difference? You see how important that difference is? Now, when we move into next week's discussion here, we start talking about the right ceremonies to propitiate the right deities and the right entities and getting the devas and the angels, because the masters who created all these things perceived that these subtle energies were there, and then they began to teach us how to work in harmony with them. Now, I think I'm going to take a break before I go on because it's another direction. Okay, let's take a few minutes and then we'll go back with this. Okay, Saturday from 6 to 10. It's one of the nicest events of the year. It's in the community. And it's storytelling and music and meditation and a little ritual, and it's the far greater than the sum of its parts. So it just, we set up beautiful altars to all the masters, and then we sort of travel from one to the other. It's like taking a pilgrimage. And I don't know why it always comes out so terrific, but it always does. So that's, if you can possibly make it, and you think 4 hours, what will I do? But it just goes by in a moment. It could be the weather like it is, it could be a little cool by 10 o'clock, so you might want to start in summer clothes and at least have fall clothes by the end to put on. Well, last year it was so hot, we waited, it was so hot at 6 o'clock that we just all went and threw ourselves into the river, which was the swimming pool. Yeah, because, I mean, I'm standing here just absolutely dead and everybody's just looking at me like, you actually expect us to be inspired? So we just went and threw ourselves in the pool with our clothes on. It was very nice. It was very, very nice. It made it work. with their clothes on, yeah. But it saved the day. Yeah, it certainly, you know, cooled my brain out. But that was only because, but it sometimes turns extremely hot on that day for some little, you know, quirk of fate. But I hope this year it won't. All right. Okay. I can't think of anything else to tell you about, but there's probably other things. Okay. We're ready to start. I was asked a question during the break, which I'd like to answer but first let me ask if there's any others, so I'll know whether I have more than one to answer. Are there any questions or comments here? Yes, John. Oh, do we have, could you hand him the microphone? Mm-hmm. Okay.
How does one dance from the third eye, you know?
How do you dance from the third eye?
Right.
Well, so... You know, it's interesting. Before I actually say that, there was this little documentary. I was in Swami's house, and it was in his house. I have no idea where it came from. And it was film of a lot of different visionaries, people who've had visions of Divine Mother, real visionaries, people that you've never heard of, all over the world, different ages, a lot of them quite young, including the ones in Medjugorje who are well known. And there was this, of course I'm talking to you, there were some of the people in Africa. There were some African girls. There was this young girl in Africa, maybe 15, 16. It was the film was extraordinary because she's just talking to the cameraman about her visions, and then a vision comes on her. And faster than you can follow it with your eye, even though the camera was right on her face, she just transformed. She transformed from perceiving this world to perceiving another world. And she was just in this vision, and then you see her speaking ecstatically, and then she comes out of it. The coming out of it was not as remarkable as the going in, or maybe they didn't have it on the film. Now, this is a Catholic girl in a Catholic setting, but it's the whole thing is Africa. And then later on, they showed the worship of these Catholics with their African priests. And of course, you know, that whole culture has that, which is partly why you're asking, has that wonderful rhythm. When Ram went to Nigeria and South Africa, and Ram is a black American from Los Angeles, but he's a chameleon. Wherever he is, he really takes it on. And those who were with him said, in some indiscernible way, he played Door of My Heart, and it sounded like an African song. He just, you know, was there, and he just caught it. Well, I'm looking at this film of these Catholics, and they're doing this wonderful, you know, that sort of rhythmical, graceful dance kind of, in that kind of way that they do like that. And then they go, and it was so perfect. It was just, they just had that, and it just, there was nothing sensual, and there was nothing low consciousness. I can't, you know, you've seen Nelson Mandela, you know how that sort of, that kind of dance that they have. I'm not doing it properly, but you know what I'm seeing? But they were just doing it. They were moving, partly because I can't move, you know, because they were moving forward, they were moving backward. You know, and they were able, and there was this wonderful, marvelous drum playing like this. And then they just put right into that. And it was, but you know, everything was moving, but the whole consciousness of it was up. I mean, so it's as simple as that. It's like if you feel it, it's not like you have to just stand and go like this, you know. But you'll see people dancing, and sometimes they're just trying to get down. You know, and then you'll see people dance and you can see that they're trying to get up. I mean, naturally, there are movements that are inherently sensual. And then there are movements that aren't. But it's really just how you feel about it, what it really comes down to. Okay, it's a very important question. Dance is one of the forms that Ananda's only played with a little bit. You know, Claire has done a little bit. Andre and Cindy did a little bit. Nitai's daughter Mirabai, when she was younger, used to dance. You know, Tina and Claire have come up with that beautiful, the movements to Children of God, which we do at Easter. But there's not enough of it. It hasn't really. Swami's always, every time anybody's into dance, he's always trying to push it forward, you know, because it's such an important art form. But it's only moved forward a little bit. Yes.
It's interesting that when Vanamali Devi was doing the Divine Mother workshop that some of us went to, the end of the evening puja, she encouraged and actually had all of us dance.
Uh-huh.
And it was very divine. There was nothing sensual. It was very much coming right from what had taken place during the rest of that evening.
I mean, sacred dance has been fundamental to every religious tradition in the world. I really wish we had more of it. We worked a little tiny bit with Marguerite once. She choreographed something to Swami's music, and we talked about having a dance chorus, just like we have a dance choir, I mean, a singing choir. But no one with the inspiration from God and the training has been on site yet to carry it off. So I hope that it comes in my lifetime. Okay. Any other questions? All right. The question that was raised was to ask for just a little bit of clarification about animals and where they fit in. And Ramani was asking, because of her own attunement with animals and also because she's been reading these books by, what's his first name? J. Allen Boone, who wrote the book Kinship with All Life, which if you haven't read it recently, you should read it again. It's wonderful. It's about the dog Strongheart, who must have been a human who took the life of a dog, or he was in his absolute last dog incarnation and decided that he would really go out with him in a blaze of light. More likely, he was some advanced human who, for reasons of his own, took one life as a dog because he was so undog-like in his nature. But through his relationship with this man, this whole wonderful story is told about how much it's possible to tune in to all creatures. And he had relationship with a fly and with ants and all kinds of things where he could really commune. And through the way Strongheart taught him, what Strongheart taught him was to go beyond the limitations of the mind, really to go into the spirit, and then from the level of the spirit to feel attunement with all creatures. I was thinking in this way. I think it's in Devi Mukherjee's book, Shaped by Saints, which is a wonderful, Devi Mukherjee is a disciple of Master who is a friend of ours in India, and he wrote a book about his life, but he grew up in India, and he did a lot of trekking around the Himalayas and had a lot of really interesting experiences. And I think it was in his book where he talked, he was visiting some yogi way back in the mountains, and the yogi told him, if it wasn't Devi Mukherjee, it was someone, because it's a true story. The yogi said, you know, stay in the cabin tonight, don't come out. And then the yogi went out, and wild tigers came. And he just played with the tigers. You know, they were just like pussycats in his company, and they played together, and they had so much fun. And then afterwards, Devi said, I want to learn how to do that. I mean, can I come out with you next night? He said, no. He said, your consciousness isn't such. They would hurt you. You know, because the yogi had transcended to the point where he was able to be unified with them and there was no problem, but he knew that Devi's consciousness, even though elevated, just simply wasn't that refined. And then the tigers would feel that consciousness and it wouldn't work the same. Because the tigers are still tigers. What Ramani and I were talking about is what Swami also speaks of in here. Swami speaks of, above all, what you have to be careful about is to make sure that that your love remains impersonal, is how he put it. And he was talking about, from the point of view of helping those who are less evolved than you, it's important that your love remain impersonal. And what that means is, impersonal means that there's no involvement of your own ego in your own needs. The impersonality is you're impersonal towards yourself. You're not impersonal toward the person, in the sense of being indifferent or cold. You're impersonal towards yourself, your own preferences, your own needs, your own biases, your own sentimental feelings, your own projections, that you're able to just objectively see things as they are, respond as God would have you respond without any insertion of your own reality. So the difficulty when having loving, even inspiring relationships with less evolved entities, whether it's people or animals, and it's really all the same thing, is that we have to be very careful to not project into their consciousness more than is there, or try to have them respond in ways that are our response and not really their response. Now, a very interesting, this is a very important lesson, and one of the ways we know it is because Master included this lesson in Autobiography of a Yogi. I mean, Autobiography of a Yogi is a very short book, and yet, remember, there's the whole story about the pet deer. We had this discussion in one of our sadhaka groups one night, very interesting discussion, all about animals. And that was when I realized that Master includes this long story about an animal in Autobiography of a Yogi. And he talks first, he talks about his personal deep affection for the animal. So here we have this picture of a God-realized Master who's talking about his affection for this animal. I like the animal, I was so fond of him, he slept in my room with me. And then he fed him with his own hand from the bottle. So you have this picture of Master here just with this little deer, putting all his energy and his love into this little deer. And then he talks about how he went to town and he warned them, don't overfeed the deer. But then it happened and the deer was overfed and then the deer is sick and dying. So Master then wants the deer to live and he's praying for the deer to live and he's using all the power he has for the deer to live. I mean, this is partly a charade, but he's doing all of this. And then the deer has to appeal to him. Wait a minute. I don't want to be a deer forever. Don't confine me to this deer body. Why would I stay in this deer body? I'm done. Let me go. And then Master realizes I want the deer to live, but the deer doesn't want to live. And I was thinking, just talking to Ramani just now, how ironic this is. You see, to be attached to a body and be determined to live when it's time for it to go is not a mark of high consciousness. And yet, we get so desperate when our animals begin to die. We so want them to stay in those bodies, but it's not high consciousness on our part or high consciousness on theirs. Because really, I mean, it's nice to be somebody's loved pet, but it's not such a picnic to be an animal. It's something you really want to get beyond. I mean, they don't really have a lot of capacity. They just kind of hang around. And I saw this little joke. Two cats are standing outside the apartment door, and there's a little pet door there, and one cat says to the other, he says, I go in and out through the little door. The big door is for the servants. Well, I mean, but still, it's all about eating and sleeping. And one of my friends once had a dream in which he dreamt he was a bear. And it was a super conscious dream, I think, in the sense that he had a real experience. And the thing he observed above all was how profoundly limited the consciousness was. He was hungry, he was afraid, he was satiated, he was sleepy, then he was hungry, then he was afraid, then he was satiated, then he was sleepy. I mean, there was just like, there was no art, there was no music, you know, there was no refined conversations, there was no travel, there was no expanding into other cultures. He was hungry, he was afraid, you know. And really, if we stop being so personal about it and projecting upon them, really, what do they really get to experience? Just think if your life was limited to what the animals get to experience. I mean, sure, you get to cuddle up, and there's a kind of freedom in being petted and having the servants come in and out and bring you what you need. But it's not something that you're going to cling to. When you're done, you're done. Now, they teach us a lot. Animals can teach us a lot, not because they're more advanced than us, but because they're simpler than us. They don't have the overlaying complexities of all these different egoic, the thwarting cross currents of ego. That's Master's word for it, right? And so before you come into a human ego, you have a certain simplicity that allows you to tune into realities that you forget in the middle. And then you remember again at the other end. So that's why the creatures are put here, because they open our hearts. And by their simplicity, they teach us lessons that we need to know. But they're not beyond ego, they're beneath it. Which you see is very, very different. And we should respect them and love them and revere them. And the world is going to hell in a handbasket because we're so confused on all these points. We don't have any regard for anything that doesn't meet our exact ego criteria of worth. You know, it's a terrible thing, and it's destroying the planet because we're so out of tune. You know, there's this like universal vibration which has manifested this world, and we're living in such dissonance with it that it's just creating dissonance everywhere. and it's creating hurricanes, and it will create plagues, and it will create wars, and it will create, you know, climate changes and all these different things, because we're out of harmony with that vibration. And that vibration, the first precept of the way of Ananda Sanghis has the phrase in it, that I think it's the first precept, if not, it's the second. But it talks about how this world is a manifestation of Satchitananda, and that we are all bound together by this Satchitananda in a web of mutual service. It's a very, very profound and interesting statement, and that's what we've forgotten. You know, the animals are serving us. We're the higher beings serve the lower beings. You know, the lower beings serve the higher beings. It's all a web of mutual service, but we need to remain impersonal about it and be inspired by what's truly inspiring. That's why Swamiji writes about, he writes about the birds. Birds sing of freedom as they soar lightly on the air. So may our hearts soar high above all curbs and care. So you see the birds, and they're divine teachers, and it is appropriate for us to be extremely grateful to them for what they teach us. But we shouldn't become so personal about it that we think that that little robin right there, you know, is wiser than this one over here, because he's simpler. And in his simplicity, he may appear more wise than this extremely ego-conflicted being over here. But on the scale of evolution, you know, towards self-realization. Now, we have intriguing things like Lahiri Mahashaya, toward the end of his life, was working on a technique to liberate animals directly. What on earth does that mean? You know, that he could just inspire them to not have to go through the human stages? Now, wouldn't that save a lot of time and trouble? You know, you just don't even know where to go with a thought like that. And if you go to Ramana Maharshi's ashram in southern India, there's a Maha Samadhi Mandir. Maha Samadhi means a yogi's final conscious exit from the body. And when a great yogi has his Maha Samadhi, they make a temple, a mandir, and then it's called the Mahasamadhi Mandir, and the body is buried there. A great yogi's body is not cremated, but it's buried. At Puri, where Sri Yukteswar lived, there's a little Mahasamadhi Mandir in his body. If you read Mejda, after Sri Yukteswar died, his body in the lotus posture was set in a brick-lined cavity in the sand, and a little temple was built over it. There's no really Mahasamadhi Mandir to Yogananda, which is a great... lack of taking responsibility on the part of the disciples. We should have built one for him by now. But at least he's buried where he's buried. Shivananda has a Mahasamadhi Mandir. Anandamoyi Ma does, and so on. Well, you go to Ramana Maharshi's place, and there's a Mahasamadhi Mandir, and above it says, Lakshmi, the cow. There was a cow who was deeply devoted to Ramana Maharshi. And Ramana Maharshi claims that when that cow died, the cow was liberated. Was that cow a fallen yogi? You don't know what to think. But this was his statement, and he was in a position to say, you know, he was a very advanced soul. What, by the devotion of the cow? Your mind goes completely crackers. But except for that, we have to remain very impersonal about these things in order to be of real service. Thus, Master's story. Deeply attached, you know, deeply affectionate, totally attentive, but when it was time for it to move on, standing back and allowing truth to carry the day and not mere sentimentality. Is that helpful? Okay. Well, animals can do, animals have, because they don't have the conflicting cross currents of ego. And in his stories are, you know, the dog that gets left behind on the East Coast and shows up in California. I mean, just remarkable things that animals can do out of some kind of connectedness. And primitive people, so to speak, often have tremendous psychic powers. Swamiji talked about being somewhere. I don't know whether it was Bali or where it was, but the husband went to the store, to the next village to go to the store, and the wife had forgotten to tell him something, so she went down to the tree at the end of the lane, and through the tree was able to communicate to him that he should bring such and so back. And he got the message, but she had to use the tree as an intermediary. You know, then you come to the whole question of plants, which we might as well talk about trees especially. Swamiji has you know, there's a lot of people who get very defensive about any tree being cut down. And when Swamiji moved to the Crystal Hermitage and built what is now the Crystal Hermitage, he stood there and you know, he's looking at these huge trees, take that one down, and that one. People just had a fit that he was cutting down these big trees. He was completely indifferent. And then he said, you know, first of all, again, here we're acting as if the trees are attached to that form. No, we're saying that they're so advanced that they're afraid to die, which of course is oxymoronic. That can't be true. If you're advanced, then you're indifferent to your form. He said, if you brutalize anything in nature, then you set in motion brutal forces. You know, people who, without regard for the balance of anything, just think in terms of their own profit and take down trees, then it's not so much that the tree itself suffers because it doesn't have enough ego consciousness to be self-conscious, but a dissonance is created. And you can, you know, you can hear the tree cry, but what you're hearing is all of nature is dissonant. But when you're moving things out to make things more beautiful, and Swami writes this, we read it on his birthday. He writes a letter in the book of letters that's coming out. He says, you know, the trees are happy to cooperate when what you're doing is creating more harmony and more beauty. And he pointed out, not in that letter, but in all the fairy tales, you know, the untended forest is always where the demons live, isn't it? The Rakshasas are always in some chaotic forest that's just been left to itself without any intervention or attempt to make it beautiful. Why do you think that's so? Because that kind of disorder and no intervention from higher consciousness. See, it all comes down to the fact that development is directional from less sentient beings to more aware beings. And even though dolphins are remarkable, we have to take the word of the masters on this. The dolphin's nervous system is not capable of perceiving infinity. The human is the top of that scale. And of course, can abuse it. So the trees too, it all depends on the consciousness with which you're doing it. Swami was certainly sensitive enough to know that those trees were happy to make way for the extraordinary beauty and happiness that would be created by their absence in the beautiful view that would result. And merely to leave them there because they're there, but that was the stage before this new vibration comes in, and it all depends on how it's done. Master himself criticized people for being insensitive when they were treating a tree roughly. Can't you feel it's alive, he said, because they weren't respecting it. But at the same time, he was transforming the landscape of Lake Shrine and making it into a place of beauty and refinement where it had just been neglected prior to that. You see how impersonal you have to be? You have to be just very impersonal and just look at it in terms of true consciousness and not just sentiment. Okay, does that all make sense? No, that's just what I was saying. He criticized them for being rough and not respecting it. But that's the respect for the whole web of life. But that doesn't mean you can't influence it. Man was put on earth to work with the Creator to make greater and greater beauty. So if you're there to make greater and greater beauty, uplifting beauty, then nature rejoices with you. If you're just there and afraid to touch it and argue about whether you can touch it, it's our job is to create greater and greater beauty and higher vibrations. And trees are happy to cooperate with. That's why they're there too. They were just holding the place, you know, and then when it's time for them to move on, they're not attached to their bodies. They don't have that kind of consciousness. Impersonal. Okay, does it for tonight? All right. Thank you all very much. We'll see you next week.